We got a real simple plan. One me and one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
You're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven. This might be college football heaven.
This is ESPN's College Game Day Podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel, here's Reese Davis.
It's official. Georgia just reloads. Maybe it's because they're now comfortable donning a Stetson. The Hawkeye State is Iowa because there is no O. And the try, the extra point, or two-point conversion, the try. There is no try. Do or do not. And so, so many did not. This is the College Game Day Podcast for Monday, September 5th. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel here. And Pete, the try, the official name for the extra point. And so many tried so hard. Nobody tried harder than LSU at the end of the LSU-Florida State game on Sunday night, which was absolutely bizarre, completely fitting. You had two muff punts. In my judgment, errors in the replay booth on the goal line. Now, they got the call right, but the mechanics of getting there were wrong. Strange out-of-bounds play at the end of regulation. Stop the clock, not stop the clock. I mean, it had everything weird you could imagine. I mean, Joe Tessitore and Greg McElroy did an unbelievable job calling the game, but I don't know that I've seen a more recent, bigger Tess effect than the bizarre nature of that LSU Florida State game.
That was like a mind bender. I mean, just a complete and utter mind bender. I almost went to bed. And, you know, I mean, it was like a two-score game in the third quarter, LSU. Like, Kayshon Booty was like apathetic. Would that be a nice word?
But yes.
It just didn't seem like there was any juice. Jaden Daniels was like reminding, it was not freshman year, Jaden Daniels. Let's put it that way. And it just, some teams like have played with an energy bolt. Like, right. Like I think of like Florida State in week zero, I watched a bunch of that game. They played with an energy bolt. There are teams that this weekend played with, and Georgia played with three energy bolts, right?
Yes.
There was just not that bolt from LSU until there was. And then it was an unbelievable bolt. And I guess the one thing I was just thinking there was like, I kept thinking back when that ball hit the ground and LSU, of course, started moving it, unlike they had all game. I was like, poor Mike Norvell, because you remember the Jacksonville State game last year. And that's like all my mind went to. And to me, his celebration was a little bit like Jimmy V looking for somebody to hug when that extra point got blocked. He was just like, he was just dancing with himself, and then he was like jumping on someone's shoulders. And it was, I think, for that program, which has been lost in the wilderness really since the end of Jimbo Fisher's time there.
Right.
Yeah. I think it was just they haven't had a huge momentum game. They almost had it against Notre Dame last year, the same weekend. I think that game was Monday night. No, that was Sunday night.
That was Sunday night game, too. Sunday night. Sure was.
Like they were
McKenzie Milton.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, that would have been like McKenzie Milton would have been on Good Morning America the next day if they came back and won. They've teased it at times. Talking to Norvell this summer, he really felt like their skill was showing that Florida State was Florida State again, right? Mm-hmm. And George Travis, like that was, he played, I thought he was big time.
You know, I thought he was terrific.
He made plays on the run. He was accurate. He made good decisions. Remember Reese going into the season, there was this muddle of ACC quarterbacks, right? Mm-hmm. There were a lot of good upper middle class. You could call them stars if you want ACC quarterbacks. Well, to me, Jordan Travis, that was a separator game. You know, like a couple of those guys went the wrong direction. Obviously, our prayers are with Sam Hartman, who had an ailment that he's going to be out for an unspecified period of time for. But there was, you know, Devin Leary was just okay.
And threw a costly interception.
Ooh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Nearly costly. One that put him in jeopardy.
Although they bungled that goal line stuff so bad in that game.
Yeah.
Anyway, we don't want to go down a rabbit hole. Like that was, if you needed to celebrate the unconventional, messy, wondrous, chaotic nature of college football, the last 3 minutes of LSU Florida State would be a nice. If you had to tell someone from bring someone from Mars, yeah, and show them why college football is great, that all pretty much summed it up, including with like an 8 minute review thrown in.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there are a couple of things that I felt like when LSU went down, they got the touchdown on fourth and goal, but the third and goal that got stopped just short, the officials ruled it correctly. They rushed to the line, they got the snap off, they scored. Whistle comes in just as they score, replay booth. And, you know, you can say, okay, they were in a hurry. The replay officials need time. The mechanism needs to be better, in my judgment. You stop it before they snap it, or you don't stop it too late. And now it all came out in the wash. Just oddly enough, as the two muffed punts sort of came out in the wash, because you know, Florida State didn't convert the first one into points, and then the one at the end of the game that could have sealed it, they put themselves in harm's way. Let me say this. It's so easy to sit here and second guess. Sure. And that's not really what I intend to do. But the little pitch play on the goal line that Florida State ran that fumbled, that gave LSU the last chance, look, the pitch should have been better from Jordan Travis and the running back. I've forgotten who was in the game at the time, but you know, if you have to stop and secure the ball, do that. I know it's hard instinctively, but knowing the time and score of the situation, ball is the most important. And they didn't do that. But the call put them in position to make that mistake. In fact, if you read Jordan Travis's lips on the sidelines, I don't think he was pleased with the play call. And it didn't seem like it. Now, you couldn't hear it, but I was reading his lips and something like, call that something, you know, he didn't approve. And he was right. You know, at the end of the day, he was right. Now, should they have executed better? Absolutely. But he was right. Then the drive down the field and Jaden Daniels, Mark, almost like, remember the drive he had for Arizona State against Michigan State on the road? Yes. He kind of kept taking him down there, running, moving the chains. And it was very reminiscent of that. And he got down and made the clutch play, and then they get the extra point block. It was just it was a cavalcade of errors and miscues, and it was all dramatic and fun.
You're not going to ever mistake me for Johnny Analytics, right? I have a full respect for analytics. Our friend Bill Connolly is a maestro of them, who we have on the Friday pods and pick. But just I did not grow up covering college football through the prism of numbers. So that said, can you bang three knees and just kick a field goal there and win the game? Like,
yeah.
I don't think this is some, like, you need an MIT study.
Right.
To do that. Now, you certainly don't pitch the ball. You have to minimize risk in every way. Even if they ran Jordan Travis, who's a perfectly fine runner. You know what I mean? It's not Joe Bledsoe back there, right? If you ran him three times, you trust him as an upperclassman to hold on to the ball, but like just win the, you know, win the game. Like, just North Carolina had a couple chances to just win the game.
Yeah.
And they did not do that against App State. And that was, I mean, we could do a whole podcast on that, you know, that mess. This is my favorite stat of the weekend. App State scored 40 points in the fourth quarter and lost. Now, I'm sure there have been 40-point quarters involving directional Louisiana's and SEC school. Like, I'm sure that's happened, that somebody scored 40 points in a quarter. But 40 points in a fourth quarter and losing, I'm going to challenge our stats ninja Marissa Dowling to find another 40-point fourth quarter lot. Like, that, if that's happened ever in the history of the sport, I'd be pretty stunned. That was remarkable. So replay mechanism, interesting you bring it up. And we were obviously at the Ohio State game, so we were not locked in on the Florida-Utah game. I had it on my laptop, but like it's hard when you're at a game to watch another game, with full clarity. But there was a replay mechanism, you know, from what Utah people were gathering, gaff there, where it looked like they had scored on a run at the goal line. And Whittingham basically said, I was waiting to hear from them, and it didn't happen. Now, the clarity of what that score was and how obvious it was, I can't sit here and stand on the table for it. But I do think there is some ambiguity in that process, Reese. And that, like, literally could impact the national championship race.
There, you know what? I want to stay on this weekend for a minute, sure. But I want to bring this up briefly and remind you the Week in Review is brought to you by Eckrich Smoked Sausage. Find them in the refrigerated meat aisle at your favorite grocery store to create a one-of-a-kind sausage recipe. Eckrich, you do you. It's not just one sausage recipe. You can get a whole bunch of them there. You know, there are a lot of recipes for winning. The review on the goal line was one. That's why I like the fact that our rules are, you know, answer to their own master, not necessarily always just following the NFL. I would like the replay to be a little more challenge oriented, I think, because then you would have some clarity, as you said, about, you know, if Mike Norvell wants to stop the clock and see if the guy got in or didn't get in, which, you know, or Brian Kelly wants to, you know, they can do that. Even if Norvell's like, okay, look, that ruling went in our favor. We're not quite set on defense. Look at that. He might have already gotten in, might buy him a minute. You know, whatever he wants to do, he controls it or is controlled on the field a little bit more. Might be a bad example there, but you get the point. Letting them control when it stops. The other thing is the two-point conversion overtime, which came into play in the Houston-UTSA game. Okay. And we don't have to go too far down this, but since we're on the subject mm-hmm. of extra points, we've got to get ahead of this. The rules committee has to get ahead of this. We can't have, with the expanded playoff and the emphasis on the postseason, cannot have a playoff game, a national championship game decided by two-point conversions. Can't happen. I know it's probably a long shot. I get it. Can't happen. Not in the two-point shootout. If it happened, if it's decided on a two-point conversion because somebody decides to try one, fine. Can't have it. Got to change. You know, got to get ahead of it before it happens. And, you know, look, it could still happen in a 14 playoff. But, I mean, I'm looking as we expand it. You sure don't want that. You don't want it anytime, but you sure don't want that.
Yeah, we can call that the Bielma rule because that, like, how ridiculous and preposterous that was, I think was epitomized by that Illinois-Penn State game last year, Reese, where it was like, it's like deciding an NBA playoff game with a three-point contest.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's pretty much what it comes down to. And what did they go, 9 overtimes last year?
Yeah, 9 overtimes.
In Illinois and Penn State. And it was a charade. I mean, there's no other way to say it. It was not football as it was designed to be. And I respect play counts. I respect injuries. Mm-hmm. I thought the mechanism of touchdown forcing 2-point was a legitimate variable mm-hmm. that, you know, impacted the game enough where you weren't going to get, but it's actually created more, you know, overtimes and plays in a lot of ways too. So I'm with you 10,000% that, and I'm surprised it didn't change because that was just bad ball, man, last mm-hmm. year. I mean, mm-hmm. that was bad ball in every possible way. Nobody won there. And I was actually listening to that game on the radio driving to another game. And there was like dramatic pauses because remember the teams had to go from one side to the other.
Yeah.
So it was like, we're gonna go jog 80 yards to run a fullback dive that fails to then run like 80. You know, it was just like, there was just a lot of, yeah, there was a lot of nonsense there.
Before we move on, there's one quick thing I want to mention. ESPN and Andscape contributor Dominique Foxworth has a new podcast, The Dominique Foxworth Show. You've heard him right here on The Right Time with Bomani Jones for Foxworth Fridays. You see him all over TV. Now he has his own podcast with new episodes Tuesdays and Thursdays throughout the season. Dominique is bringing his unique perspective on football, the personalities around it, just about anything else he finds interesting or thinks you might find interesting. Follow The Dominique Foxworth Show wherever you get your podcast or on the ESPN NFL YouTube channel. There's a lot of weirdness, but you know, not all two-point plays are bad. I mean, heck, that's how Iowa scores now. I'm really trying to work on my pronunciation of Iowa because there is no O in it. Their defense scored more safeties than their offense did. I mean, that was South Dakota State's a really good FCS team. I think they're ranked Amen. Second in one of the polls. Terrific team. And it would have been no shame at all, you know, if the Jackrabbits had gone in there and upset them and, you know, won kind of, you know, the normal, typical FCS over FBS upset, they're a good team. But I mean, to go in there and average just over a yard and a half per carry, 4 yards per attempt. Pete, Iowa got the ball 16 times.
16 times.
16 times. On average, they had 58 yards to go to score a touchdown.
And their punter is unbelievable.
Yeah, he's terrific.
Yeah. Yeah. What a weapon.
Yeah. He was good last year. I think we threw out t-shirts at a game day that Torrey Taylor, right? The punter at Iowa. I think we threw out t-shirts that they sent to us about him because he was Matt Arizin, and I realized what a difficult thing it is to bring up his name given his circumstances. But what he did as a punter on the field last year for San Diego State eclipsed Taylor a little bit as the season went on. But boy, he's a terrific punter. He won. He and Jack Campbell, who is just a tackling machine, won the game for them. But there's really no excuse for the offense to be this bad. And it's easy to sit here and Iowa fans want, to blame it all on Spencer Petras. They can't run the ball. They can't protect him. Receivers transferred to Purdue. I think they have some other injuries. I mean, it's not all on that dude, and he shouldered it like a man, from what I've been able to tell over the last couple of years. They have to find a way. They're like the only good team in the sport. The defense is good. They can't move the ball at all. I mean, you compare their defense to their offense, and it's like taking Iowa's finest beef with the perfectly cooked steak and washing it down with the backwash from a week-old bottle of Natty Light. It's like guzzling champagne when they're on defense. And then chasing it with shots of Ipecac syrup that make you want to throw up. I mean, these two things do not go together, and their defense deserves better to have something on off, something. You don't even have to score much to win the game with those guys out there on defense, and they can't do it. I mean, but the one thing they'll probably be able to do is beat Iowa State because Iowa State can't beat them. I mean,
six in a row.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. Do you want a story about Iowa's quarterbacking that'll make Iowa fans throw up in their mouth a little bit?
Without the Ipecac syrup?
Without the Ipecac syrup. I don't know what Ipecac syrup is, by the way.
It's stuff that if you get poisoned, they may have other uses too, but you get it and it makes you get discharge the poison.
Sure. That makes sense. So the pandemic year 2020, I did a big profile of Zach Wilson and his dad, Mike Wilson's a big character, walked me through his whole recruitment. He had originally committed to Brian Harsin at Boise, decommitted, and credit Kalani Sitake. Mm-hmm. They whiffed on him early. They had run off Detmer as their OC. His nephew was going to be their quarterback in that class. They didn't offer him. Kalani Sitake showed up at the house. He's like, hey, I messed up. All right. Like, I am recruiting your son, and went and got it done. But in that time, a bunch of people came in and they took some visits, and they were like waiting for like the night before they were to fly to Iowa to go visit Iowa. And they really liked Iowa. Spencer Petras committed and Zach Wilson did not go to Iowa. And that, again, that's a 2-year-old. It's in the story I wrote for Yahoo, but like it's that in my mind, but like they had identified him, they had gone out and seen him. They liked him. He liked them. I'm not saying he would have committed on the visit because he was kind of staying open a little bit and ultimately decided to stay home. But yeah, that was a bad day. And I think Utah had Jack Tuttle, mm-hmm. who at the time was like one of their highest rated quarterbacks.
Yeah.
And yeah, from Southern California in history. And pesky old Zach Wilson, there's a couple, boy, what would have happened? Boy, what would have happened if he stayed committed to Boise? Boy, what would have happened if he went to Iowa? But then you could also say, what would he have become if he went to those places? Yeah, quarterbacks they are very circumstance driven.
Yeah. You've done the background and I'm riffing top of my head here, but if my memory serves me correctly, was it Spencer Petras? Did he go to the same high school as Jared Goff?
He's from Northern California.
Yeah. I was thinking for some reason, or maybe it was a league thing. And look, I may be wrong about this. I shouldn't just throw things out willy nilly on the podcast. There are a lot of things going on. They get filed away and sometimes they get misfiled. for some reason, it rings in my mind that he broke a bunch of Jared Goff's high school records in passing. It's not as if this guy, and I always try to default to the side of all of these guys are good. They're all good. Spencer Petras is a good player. Sometimes the circumstances don't line up. Sometimes, you know, you lose some confidence because you don't have success. If you are a Division I quarterback, starter, backup player, you're good, man. You're a good player. And he is. They're in a
Marin Catholic for both, by the way. Marin Catholic.
I believe he broke a whole bunch of Jared Goff's high school records.
Yeah.
So no, he's not some slappy coming in there going, hey, can I play quarterback? He was good. And he is
he was
good.
Not a JUCO walk-on.
He's a good player. He needs to perform better. I know Iowa fans are sitting here ready to come through the podcast and get after me because you always want to blame the quarterback. And by the way, that's the business quarterbacks choose. And when they choose to be a quarterback, you get all the glory that goes with it. And when things don't go well, as they certainly are not going well at Iowa, you get more than your share of the blame. And I think Brian Ferentz is going to get a whole bunch of the blame. And as good as they've been on the offensive line forever, that was not evident on Saturday either. But we've probably talked more about this than I intended to, but just because I don't know. I thought it was kind of amusing to take the O out of Iowa, but you know.
Yeah. Well, we want to talk about epitomizing the glory of opening weekend. Yeah. You have dueling safeties winning the Iowa South Dakota State game with the complete acid trip of the fourth quarter of App State UNC. I mean, those just like, and I literally went back to my hotel after game day and I had both on in my room. And like one is mesmerizing in a completely different way than the other is mesmerizing. Yet they're both kind of mesmerizing.
It's, you know what, I put them up in the bus too, and it was great watching. I was watching them side by side.
Different sports.
Yeah. Do you think I used to have and still do, sometimes I have this recurring dream that I can't get to the set, you know, that you're trapped somewhere. You can't go, you can't find everything. You can't get everything you need. It's like the complete frustration of not being able to get to the set. I think that's the dream that the Appalachian State receivers going to have on the 2-point conversion that would have put them up late. That when they ran the play and he was actually open, and for some reason he turned around and Chase Bryce, who's a terrific young man, by the way, kind of laid it out there. At first, I thought, Chase, make it easy for him. And I think that when he threw, he thought he was sort of in. You know, the receiver sort of turned around, then he starts backpedaling, then he loses his balance. And I mean, all I could think of was that's the dream I have that I think a lot of people have of being the frustration that you can't get to quite where you need to be. And I mean, I believe they would have won the game with that, even though, I mean, who knows with that
who
game,
knows?
I think they win the game if they get that. Yeah. They keep
that ball was out in the air for approximately 3.5 minutes. It was like, and like, it was like the receiver's feet were in quicksand. Like these are 18 to 22 year olds, man. And those moments they can catch up to you, you know?
Yeah.
That is, man. But that was because you watch the play unfold and you're like, he's wide. You know, it seemed like, I assume it was like the nickel corner made a decision that he was going to collapse. And all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, this has happened.
And it looked like the exact same play when they ran it again to try to tie it. And this time, there are a couple of coaching decisions. And that's a tough one because, you know, you think, okay, it worked last time. We'll have somebody open. And he had nothing the second time, you know, when they were trying to tie it. Hey, what was your take on, running the onside kickback? And I'll just go ahead and tell you, I'm all in on that. You build your lead, you make it harder. I've heard people say, just fall down. I get it. House it, man. House the thing. Put the extra points on the board. You don't have to fall down. It's okay if you do, but I was all right. I mean, come on. With that few seconds, you don't think you can stop them.
Yeah. Remember Notre Dame Toledo last year?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where I think it was Daquan Finn. It was like 3rd and 11 minus 30, something like that. And Daquan Finn, you know, takes his own read and houses it. And if he had needed and they drained some clock and kicked the field goal, Toledo would have won in Notre Dame Stadium. And I could not ever in I'm more critical and cynical than most, I would think, Reese. I could never find it in my dark heart to criticize someone for making a football play like that.
Right.
Because again, and I am non-analytical in nature, as I said before, right? Like if the special teams coach at North Carolina is good enough to tell his hands team, you know what he's worried about? Catch the darn ball.
Catch
right?
the ball.
Like,
yeah.
like that's what now it, look, it is a fine point, and maybe in the NFL, in that same scenario, some guy may be coached and aware enough to do that. But again, in the middle of that acid trip, that was that game, obviously. If he had the wherewithal to go out of bounds to knee, I don't know. Like that would be very hard with, you know, with your competitive juices flowing and everything. Let's put it this way. If a guy actually had the awareness to do that, I would give him all the credit in the world, because that would just be, that would be a monster awareness play. But to expect him to, I just think that's disingenuous.
Or even to, even to think it's the right play, because you're putting the thing away, much like Florida State was trying to, how you choose to put it away. That was a different discussion about Florida State's pitch play on the goal line. Mm-hmm. But you're trying to put the game away, because what happens? I mean, we saw weird stuff happen at the end of Florida State and LSU. What if Carolina guy, you know, falls? They take an A on the, oh, all of a sudden the ball. I mean, that was a weird game. Maybe they fumbled the snap.
UNLV Baylor. Remember UNLV Baylor a couple years ago? The Kevin Steele game where they like returned a UNLV Baylor. Somebody returned a fumble.
It was Baylor like UNLV. Yeah. Kevin said he wanted an attitude touchdown.
Yeah.
He hasn't been a head coach since, although. Yeah. You know, well, I won't go into the whole attempt to make him one.
He was close.
I love Kevin. And, you know, he was trying to change the culture, turning it into a winning culture. Had the game won. Yeah. He wants the attitude touchdown. UNLV of all teams, what, they stripped the ball or picked up a fumble. They ran it 100 yards or 99 yards and beat him.
You know, now Carolina could have taken three knees. I've never seen a team lose in victory position. I'll say that. I've never seen a team lose in victory position. So,
but you'd never seen a team score 40 points in the fourth quarter and lose. So you never know.
That is true. I will say this. If you are going to mildly criticize anyone for that Carolina decision and they won, it would be for the special teams coach to not win. Like modern football, 10 years ago, up one, nobody would have even discussed doing that. Right. Mm-hmm. But now, like if you're up one, you know, it's almost like the game's tied. Like you have to operate somebody can come back and tie you. Just that's the way football has evolved and changed with offenses being so prolific and everything. So I do think the very detailed special teams coaches, look, special teams is a hard job to coach, because nobody's other than your kickers are there primarily to do it. But I do think there were some notes written down saying, if we are ever about to field an onside kick up one, we have to tell in certain time parameters, right? You can't do it with, you know, you'd have to really like have it clock oriented and dialed oriented. So, mm-hmm. The analytics guys are adding notes to their weekly packets that they send to their coaches.
You and I have not had many what I would call disagreements on the podcast. There have been some slight variances of opinion. I think I was much stronger early on that Georgia was in the upper echelon with Alabama and Ohio State. Now that you saw Stetson Bennett and whatever he did, spinning magic bean and being a Northeastern guy, someone made the comparison to the great Doug Flutie. Now, Stetson's fast. I don't think he's the scrambler that Doug was, but there
he looked it on that one play.
Woo. Yeah. I mean, there are some similarities.
That was like an ode to Bo Nix.
With a better outcome.
Yes,
I want to bring up something about Bo in a minute. But Stetson Bennett, I'm going to say it again. I said it all year on our podcast before we called it the College Game Day podcast. Pollock he fights with me about who's the actual driver on the bandwagon. And finally, I think we've agreed that we're the co-drivers. He's good. Everybody just understand, get it through your head. This guy can play. He's a top shelf quarterback. Is he maybe the number one pick in the draft? No, that doesn't matter. He's really good. He sees things. He's got enough arm. He's a terrific athlete. He's gutsy. He will turn the football loose. And I'll ride with that dude. I think he's an excellent quarterback.
Yeah, and look, he was every bit of everything you and your fellow bandwagoners had said. My skepticism of Georgia was somewhat skill related, also just defensive personnel. Like, could we expect them to roll out of bed having lost, what was it, 9 defensive guys to the draft? Something preposterous.
Yeah, 5 first rounders. Yeah.
I'm leading the Jalen Carter bandwagon. I had, you know, stayed on the sideline on Saturday night. A scout kind of said offhanded to me, like, he could be the number one pick, if only because there are a lot of Will Andersons, not in college football, but in the NFL. There's a lot of guys to do that. There are more humans who are elite edge rushers than there are guys who can do what you can do in the middle there. And I'm not predicting he'll be the number one pick in the draft, but when you talk about what NFL teams value and who are the rarest commodities outside of like surefire quarterbacks, it would have to be some of those interior guys. But I just thought there could be an acclimation period. That acclimation period happened between kickoff and the first possession. Yeah.
let me tell you what some around Georgia have said about Jalen Carter. You may have already heard this too. Those guys we lost last year, first round picks, great leaders, tremendous players. We love them and we're going to miss them dearly. But at least we've still got the best one on the roster. Yes. There were many people there that felt like that he was the best guy already. I'm going to do something. I'm working on it with our social media team. I think it sparked from when we were comparing Cincinnati, Arkansas to a demolition derby. So I'm going to try to put together RD's demo reel every week where there's some within the rules, clean, non-injury demolitions. Jalen Carter and just running through the Oregon offensive lineman without flinching, knocking him on his keister and making the tackle is one of the great plays you'll ever see. That, you know, I mean, it's a great play, but you don't go, wow, greatest play in college, to realize how he didn't flinch and he knocked a giant human being, a starter for the Oregon Ducks, on his butt and made the tackle in the backfield like it was nothing. It was amazing. He's a force, man.
Yes. Is this going to be on TikTok?
No, I don't do the TikTok thing. I'll put it on. I think the kids like to call it the gram, but I just call it Instagram. Yeah, I think that's, you know, I rely on Reva Labby and
she's elite, by the way.
Yeah,
elite.
She gets stuff. And then my daughter, Elizabeth, understands that. So I ask her.
That would work well on TikTok.
I'm just saying,
somebody can start an account for you.
I've got personal reasons, and I'm not buying into the TikTok thing. But anyway,
I'm new to TikTok thanks to Reva, and it just seems like a lot of like quick hitting like things like that. So yeah, I'm not trying to allure you onto a social media platform that I have like 19 followers. So it's
you'll have a bunch more. Reva may convince me otherwise, but she's going to have to do some work if that's the case. That the Will Anderson play is going to be 1-2 and probably the hit on Sean Shivers from Devin Witherspoon in the Illinois Indiana game, which were all clean hits, all big time hits and tremendous plays.
That's a fun idea. I'm looking forward to that. I'll be there on Saturday texting you like, oh, did you see that play from Maxion or whatever?
I want to. One more thing on the Stetson Bennett, Doug Flutie thing. Are you aware, which there's not much you aren't aware of, are you aware that Doug Flutie owns and has restored actual Batmobiles? And like the actual vehicles, the Batmobiles.
I'm not aware of that. And I live in Boston and I know like more about Doug Flutie than most. I don't know Doug. I want to be clear, but like you catch some gossip. You're at BC a lot. I know he's like played drums in a band.
Yeah.
And I know that he like would play in his 50s. He would play in like local amateur baseball leagues and like pick up basketball 8 times a week. Doug Flutie is just like the absolute epitome of the annoying guy from high school who was good at every sport. You know what I mean? And he just kept doing it into his 50s.
And still does. So he's down in Florida now. And through the dinner gala that I've hosted the last several years for the Heisman Foundation, he's very kind and gracious. We've become friendly. And I found out, I don't remember how I found out, but now he'll occasionally send me a photograph of his latest Batmobile adventure.
That's wild.
He's like, yeah, like in his garage, he's got these two. They're amazing. They're all really cool. Stetson Bennett's just about ready for a superhero car. I mean, Stetson's close to donning a cape like Flutie. Can't be Batman. I guess that's Doug. I'm not quite willing to put Stetson in Superman category. So maybe we can get some suggestions of what super vehicle Stetson Bennett should drive. Yeah.
Could we all be sitting at the SEC title game at the end of this year with Anderson, Young, and Bennett? All like, where do we put them on our ballot as the result of this game? Like, is that a reasonable scenario?
It's a reasonable scenario. I'm not willing to dismiss CJ Stroud yet.
Just I'm not dismissing anyone. But like, I think that's like, there will certainly be other variables and some rocket ship Jaren Hall type guy may come the moon. Like, I'm not trying to, you know, wish away the season and all that, but
no,
like,
I know
there's
what
a,
you mean.
There's a really yeah. good, there's a really good chance that like those are the three best players in the SEC.
Yeah.
And
it is a reasonable thing. And if Georgia turns him loose, I mean, you know, Pollock has pointed out several times, he didn't get any first team practice reps last year. This year he did. He's the quarterback, you know, now and there. And I think it showed a little bit in the way Todd Monken was willing to turn him loose and let him play a little bit. And that helped, well, that'll help that defense come along. I'm not sure that I think I actually know that you're right, or I should say I agree with you, that Georgia's going to have some times they'll be a little more challenged. I thought they would be at times on Saturday, but their talent is ridiculous. And they're in that mode that I think you called it last time about high-profile recruit, become starter, goes to the NFL. Next guy does it over and over again. I think they're there. So that's what we'll see over the course of the season. But even with Alabama over the years doing that, you've occasionally seen the year where they're acclimating to those roles and there's the occasional bust and glitch. That's what I think you'll see from Georgia. I didn't see 49-3 or whatever it wound up being coming. I thought Georgia would win convincingly. Didn't think Oregon would be as abysmal on offense and really on both sides of the ball as it was. Was that just a case of Georgia being good, or are you alarmed about Oregon long term?
Not alarmed about Oregon long term. Like, it just, remember what happened to Chip Kelly's first game? They went to Boise. They melted down. LeGarrette Blount punched a guy in the face. Chip ended up okay. Oregon ended up okay. I think it was a little perfect storm. In like the eye of that storm was like, Georgia's got way better talent.
Yeah.
And so, look, Dan Lanning's 34. Like, he's got, you know, he is a rookie head coach in many, many different ways. And that was a giant challenge to go in that game against his old team 3,000 miles away. And it got away from him a little bit.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
Oregon's good. And I mean, here's the thing about Oregon and Utah, and that's why this system is nice compared to the last one. And the next system is going to be even better. Both of them have all their goals still in front of them. Now, people may hold their nose at Oregon because of the way they lost that game. And they're going to have further to go because of that. I would think that it's unlikely that they really get back in the conversation. But Utah, I mean, Utah's—it's all sitting there in front of them. I mean, they lost the game, obviously.
Yeah.
But but Utah is very good. Utah has been very good, and I think they can roll back out and really make a legitimate run at the playoff. You know, I don't know where they'll be ranked after that game, but I don't know how you could drop them like out of the top 20.
Oregon's done for this year with the playoff. That's a disqualifying loss. Absent everybody losing two or more. Utah is not. I'm 1,000% with you on Utah. Utah lost a game to a team that may or may not turn out to be better than middle of the road in the SEC. They played a tough game. They played their butts off, had a tough break at the end, and they lost. It's not disqualifying. You get obliterated like that, it's disqualifying in my mind. And I've been consistent in that, Pete. The year that Penn State, that many wanted Penn State in the playoff as a Big Ten champion, they lost two games. They had beaten Ohio State head-to-head. They had two losses, and one of those was, I think I have the score right, was 49-10 to Michigan. They got killed. And in my judgment, that was disqualifying. Mm-hmm. A loss is not. getting your doors blown off in this system when you're only dealing with four teams can eliminate you. Now, it is unlikely that Oregon plays well enough over the course of the season to even be on the cusp of it. But if they are, absent everybody else are contending for that spot, having two or three losses, in my judgment, that will be disqualifying because of the magnitude of it. Because it's like, okay, you win against the best. It's one thing to lose. It's one thing to look like you don't belong, or another thing to look like you don't belong. Oregon looked like they didn't belong. And, you know, I don't think Utah would have looked that way against Georgia. Utah went into a tough environment against Florida. They didn't win the game, but they played well. And they could have won the game. They had a chance to, but they didn't. All credit to Florida. I don't view that as a disqualifying loss the way I do Oregon's loss.
That's fair. I will bring up the 2007 principle. You lived through that 2007 season, right? Like, yeah. I did that two, I believe two loss LSU won. The famous line was they had no losses in regulation.
That's right. The hat came up with,
yes,
that one.
Yeah. I thought about the hat last night, by the way. Like the hat, that was a hat game.
That was a hat game, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
That's a great line. That was a hat game. Wes Miles, he's watching that game. He's like, yeah, I've seen this before.
Yes. Yeah. He took a nice hunk of Kentucky bluegrass, chunked it in his mouth, spit some green. Just like I drew it up. He would have faked the extra point at the end. That would have been
He would have found a way. Yeah, he would have found a way.
That was a hack game. But the 07 season, everybody lost. Do you remember that? Just everybody kept losing and kept losing. Now, I will say this. The sport 15 years later is completely different. And not that we needed another reminder that three teams have pulled away, but we got another reminder this weekend that three teams have kind of pulled away. Now, yeah. Ohio State did not obliterate Notre Dame. I thought Notre Dame acquitted themselves very well. I think Notre Dame is still strongly in that big picture conversation. But when you look at it from a pure talent perspective, and again, I spent an hour pregame talking to 5-6 scouts on the sideline of that game. To them, it's very clear. Like, those guys, the North Star is talent, and those guys see those three programs as having the volume of advantage.
Yeah. I'll give you a little peek at what I'm going to do on my ballot, though I haven't filed it yet. I'm moving Georgia to number one, and I'm going to get some pushback from Ohio State fans of why are you punishing us for, you know, not winning by as much as you expected against what a team that's ranked in the top five. I'm not punishing Ohio State for that. That was a good win over a good team. I'm rewarding Georgia, and Alabama is going to slip a spot to two. And I'm just sort of holding those two where they were in order and moving Georgia ahead of them based on performance. Yeah. And what Alabama does against Texas this week will be a big deal because, you know, Texas is a solid team. I won't move Notre Dame at all, I don't think. Yeah. I mean, it'll leave them right where I have them. I didn't have them as highly ranked as the polls. I think I had them 7 or 8 somewhere in there. I'm not going to move them at all. Yeah. The one thing that I thought of, you introduced me to a guy I'd only seen play, had met when we were in the hotel on Saturday, Mike Mickens. And I sort of relayed a story, perhaps to his chagrin, that I'd spoken to my friend Digger Phelps earlier in the day. And Digger had said, you know, I told him, hey, Digger, you know, we're in the same hotel as Notre Dame. And he's like, if you see Marcus, remind him what I told him. Save something they hadn't seen, you know, late in the game. The blitz, when they had been really, really successful, keeping the safeties back, keeping everything in front, sort of frustrating. It felt like CJ Stroud, especially without Jackson Smith and Jigba. And you come out of a timeout, if memory serves, and you decide, I'm going to heat him up, show him something they really hadn't seen, and it backfired on them. So don't think I won't bring that up to Digger. But it was, I'm not criticizing the call. You've got to vary things and do things and try to make a play, and that's what they did. But I think it shows you how little margin for error you have when you're dealing with CJ Stroud and all those weapons, man. Yes. I mean, you've got to be right and perfect every time.
Well, if you're going to take a risk in a blitz and leave an area underprotected, you probably do it for the 50-year walk-on receiver who's never caught a touchdown.
Right.
Who checks into the game unexpectedly because of some injuries and then just the normal, you know, breaks and rest and such. Like that. to me was like, okay, we could maybe give that guy a little bit of a cushion, right? Like that's actually pretty, you know, if you're going to get beat, it's not like they let Marvin Harrison run free on the side. So I thought Al Golden called a pretty good game. I thought like, I think, and I've said it on the podcast before, I think that was a really good hire. I think Notre Dame acquitted themselves on that side of the ball really well. Now, obviously, the rhythm left a little bit with Jackson Smith and Jigba's injury. It sounds like he's going to be okay, just from what Ryan Day said after the game, which is great. He's like the electric. He's the kind of player you tune in for, right? When you watch these when you watch these games. But yeah, that with every if that blitz hits and it's a strip sack and like you do have to try to force the action at some point. They had done a good job just staying sound, right? And they had called a couple early blitzes, not a ton, but there were a couple that that got home and they were able to change some momentums there. But yeah, overall, I thought like if you told Notre Dame's defense you gave them like the point totals going, they would have been like, that's not unreasonable.
Yeah, no, I want to be clear. I'm not sitting here saying that was a bad call. I'm just saying it was a call. It was a calculated risk. It was a divergent. From what they'd been doing, just didn't work, man. I mean, sometimes the other guy makes a play, and I thought Notre Dame was terrific. Now, they could find a way to be a little more explosive on offense. Sure. Yeah. I mean, fair critique, but I thought they were terrific. They looked really, really good to go in there, keep that offense in check basically the whole game. I mean, 21, we went into the season saying they're going to score 40 on everybody. Yes. Heck, if Georgia wants to beat them, they better find a way to score 41, and that Ohio State has a great offense and they are going to score 40 or 50 on most everybody. They did in Notre Dame. And I thought the Irish played great and they are tough. And Marcus Freeman initial returns, he's cut out for this. Absolutely cut out for this.
The moment did not look big for Marcus Freeman on Saturday night. There was no moment where the moment looked big. He was decisive. He was in control. They had an identity. They knew what they wanted to do, and they had a tough opponent.
Got after his offensive staff one time because they didn't get the play call in on time. I was standing close enough by to say, okay, well, he's a nice fella, but he can scorch you when he needs to.
Yeah, there's some fire there. So what were your Ohio State takeaways? Because the Buckeyes have evolved, and I think we almost have to view them through the prism of evolution, Reese, as opposed to the sort of gunslinging prism that we've come to know them.
Couple things. One, we'll start with the bad. I thought CJ looked a little tight, probably trying to live up to the expectations, probably, feeling that pressure, even if it's subliminal, that we have to make a 40-yard play every time. Thought he looked a little tight, missed some throws here and there. What I really liked about them is that when they needed to finish the game by running the ball, they finished the game by running the ball. Mayan Williams was great. I did wonder at times why 32 wasn't being fed early in the game. I'll confess that. I was like, is he banged up? Is he okay? What's happening here? But both the running backs were good, better than good. They were really good. So I think that bodes well for them long-term. So my takeaways were that it's not a lot different than what I expected. They probably didn't play their best on offense in the passing game. That happens from time to time. And I thought the defense made you work. And last year they didn't always necessarily make you work for yards. Notre Dame doesn't have the most explosive players, they've had some injuries too. But they made them earn everything. They didn't give up many cheap yards. They recovered well. They tackled well. I thought they looked much improved on defense, and my perception of the Ohio State offense has not changed at all. They're still wildly dangerous. They just ran into a good defense opening night, probably pressing just a hair here and there to make big plays, and they still found a way to win the game and come up with a game-clenching, soul-crushing drive at the end when they needed to.
Yeah. And, like, you think about the drop pass, was it Igbuka late second quarter?
Yeah.
Like that's the kind of thing where all of a sudden you get another, like they were, you know, it wasn't like they were off. They were out of rhythm. They weren't like there were no warning signs about the Ohio State offense.
No.
So somewhere in the third quarter, I tweeted, this game's become an interesting test of Ryan Day's pass happy football instincts. They may need to run the ball more to win the game. Henderson at that point had 5 carries for 36 yards. Mayan Williams had 6 for 32. And I said, does OSU try to grind it out here? Now, the list of games Ohio State has grinded out on the ground in Ryan Day's tenure there are fairly short, right? Like it hasn't done that. Now, what we saw from Ohio State now is the confluence of some new influences there. We'll start on the offensive line. They have 3 guys who may end up being first round picks on that offensive line, not in this draft, but down the road. They are very talented. Paris Johnson obviously just moved to left tackle. DeJuan Jones may be the most massive man in all of college football. I sat up this Thursday practice with Jess Sims, and she was just in awe of how big DeJuan Jones. I mean, he's just an enormous human being. But like bendy and athletic at the same time. So they also have a new offensive line coach at Ohio State, and I think you saw a difference in a little bit of the edge in the way they played together. Justin Fry, who came from UCLA, who I think is one of the rising young stars in the business. So there was a confidence in that unit that may not have been there in the past, and that is not a criticism of individuals, but that unit had not been a linchpin. That unit had been good enough at times, and quite frankly, in some high stakes games, there were times where it wasn't good enough. And so I really feel like there will be a comfort going forward for Ohio State in high leverage games to grind some people out between the tackles that may not have been there before. And boy, did Henderson have some pop tonight. I'm with you, man. I thought he probably should have got the ball a little bit more. Now, look, it's easy to call plays in the press box and outside of vacuum and everything. But just I wouldn't be surprised if he's more featured. I wouldn't be surprised if we see him get some more balls on the throw game. He is electric. I mean, top tailback in college football conversation to me. Are the 2 guys playing in Austin this weekend, Gibbs and Robinson and Travion. And I'm sure I'm missing somebody, but boy, that's a pretty good top 3 right there.
If people want to argue with it, go ahead. But preseason All-American list, I have Bijan, Travion. Those were the 2. Yeah. And Gibbs, you know, Gibbs is certainly in that conversation. You know, Deuce Vaughn as an all-purpose type guy too. He's a great player, but you're not, I mean, who could really argue with that? Look, I'm a big Henderson fan, and I want to give Williams his props too. He does not like being tackled, and apparently does not like people who line up on defense. He will run through you. I like him. They've got 2 backs. I think it's a great call. It makes Ohio State even more dangerous, I think, because we know what they will eventually do in the pass game. Is there anything else before we flip it forward just briefly to wrap up here? Because we got a couple more podcasts this week. Anything else from the weekend that really jumped out to you?
Well, we'll go a little, we like to go a little obscure here. We like to have some diversity. I think one of the, again, because of time of the kickoff, one of the games that got lost a little bit was how badly Oregon State thumped Boise.
Yeah.
Look, Oregon State's really good. They bring back almost everybody everywhere. This is a team that scored 40 on USC last year. They're up, I believe, 24-0 at the half at Boise. They, you know, the Boise came back a little bit. It's a good program. But that game with the Trojans going to Corvallis, I believe that's week 3, Reese. Is that right off the top of my head? Like, that is sound the alarms for your danger. You know, I can already tell you there'll be like fog, rain, a month. Something is going to happen at Reese Stadium that night. But give credit to Oregon State for all of the turnover in the Pac-12. When you think about Oregon, you think about Washington, you think about SC. Like Jonathan Smith, much in the way of his mentor Chris Peterson, has quietly built a sound quality football program. The last piece there was the defense. We saw some answers on defense tonight from the Beavers, or I'm sorry, Saturday night from the Beavers for the first time. So I just thought that was worth noting is that you know, the Beavers are in the conversation in that Pac-12 North.
You know what? That game is September 24th, and I went back to the hotel after the Ohio State game, and I watched that game too. And you know, Boise State played a little better in the second half, but that was a thumping. Smith's done a really, really good job there. They've, you know, dumped a couple of games here and there that's kind of kept them, I think, from grabbing attention. that time may be over. This year they looked really good. They've got another tough one this week. They've got Fresno State
on the road.
So
on the road,
that's going to be that'll be a difficult one too. Washington looked a lot better. I'm going to go ahead.
Can I make one more point?
I'm going to try not to do this. I'm going to try not to do this every week. But hey, man, the old super dog on College Game Day. How about Jed Fish and the Wildcats? How about that?
That was really, really, really impressive. And it's the contrast of the two things, right? Oregon State is a study in continuity. We spend so much time obsessing over transfers and who's new and who's going where. Hey, you got a bunch of dudes together. That's a powerful force in college football. Now that said, Jed Fish needed some new dudes because he got handed a pretty bad roster there, and they got 50.
I think they got 50 new players.
Yes. So you get Jaden Delora and you get Jacob Cowing from UTEP, who may be one of the five best receivers in the country. I mean, he was dominant last year. Everybody wanted him. He goes to Tucson, and the early results were pretty sparkling. I mean, he had a. Well, I don't have his numbers in front of me, but it was like a .159 catches. He was elite and legit, and good for Jed Fish. Like, here's the thing about the Pac-12. It ain't that hard to go from the bottom to the middle, right? Mm-hmm. And they seem like they're on that trajectory. And again, the narrative in Arizona is interesting because we're all expecting Arizona State, who goes to Stillwater, an interesting game this week, to spiral because they lost everybody from the court, right? And they obviously have the NCAA impending sanctions hanging over their head. Impending investigations, which is almost guaranteed to lead sanctions. Like, it feels like that program is teetering on the brink. And even though they crushed Arizona last year, they beat them by 50, it feels like Arizona now has some momentum. So God bless college football. You can get hot and cold very quick.
On the two buses where we watch games afterwards, if we're at the same place with the ABC guys, there's the Allstate bus that's at the stadium. Kirk and the game crew go there. I typically like to go to the College Game Day bus. I like a little solitude, just a few people, you know, in there watching games. And our coordinating producer, Drew Gallagher, was in there. You know, LC came by a little bit later on. On one of the monitors, I kept the Arizona-San Diego State game on the whole time. And that's something that happens every week. People will keep their Superdog games on, even when it's apparent that the game is won. You know, somebody said, why is that game still up? I said, because the clock is not on zero yet. Bad things can happen when you pick your Superdog. You got to whip them home. You know, so I was nothing against Brady Hoke and the Aztecs, but, you know, this is, as LC says, it's a business decision, sweetheart. You know, so we had to had to bring the Wildcats home. But they, you know what, they looked really good. They even had the awful quintessential bad Arizona play where they blocked their own punt and perhaps even injured the up back, because that didn't look pleasant, where he got hit with a kicked ball, but it resulted in a touchdown. And I thought, oh no, here they go. They answered it with a drive, and Calvin was a big part of that. And Delora was terrific too.
Never ever, this is my takeaway from week one from a picking perspective, or for those who invest, an investment perspective, never ever bet on a road favorite in week one. Just don't do it.
Yeah.
Just don't do it. If it's a road favorite in week one, don't bet on it. Okay. Like, take that money, invest in Apple stock or Amazon or whatever you want to do. Do not bet on a road favorite in week one. Look at what Louisville did. Talk about a dinosaur egg that they laid up in the carrier. Well, the artist formerly known as the Carrier Dome, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, I got chastised because I was making fun when we went inside with the Lightning. There's actually air conditioning in that building now? Because for years it was the Carrier Dome, an air conditioning company, yet the building was not air conditioned.
So they redid it somewhere around COVID, and I believe it does, but I honestly don't know that, and I should because I went to school there. But I remember they opened with Tennessee, T. Martin year, the year Tennessee won the national title, is my senior year, and like 9 ball players cramped up in the game. I mean, that place is a sweatbox. Mm-hmm. It was. I believe in the redo, air conditioning came in, but I don't quote me on that.
I think Ed Placey, one of our rushing gurus, Ed's like all over that. He said, you know, they've got air conditioning now. I said, yeah, but it was still funny anyway.
Yeah,
because it was true when it was sponsored by the air conditioning company. What's the name of it now?
Syracuse grad at ESPN. JW Wireless, a friend of mine, actually said that he put on Instagram, if they win this game, I'll actually learn what JW Wireless is. And I don't really know what it is, but it is sort of soulless. Carrier was one of those rare, like, it was one of the first brands to adopt. It was like an early adopter of stadium naming. I think they paid $1 million in perpetuity, and eventually Syracuse just got out of that deal. Yeah. So like in the early 80s, they paid $1 million. Like, it was the biggest bargain in naming rights you could ever happen. And eventually they wriggled out. But like when I was growing up watching games in Carrier Dome, I had no idea Carrier was an air conditioning company.
Yeah. Some people might not know that Wrigley is a gum.
Yeah.
Right? Something sure. like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's quite Wrigley, but it was kind of in that vein. You're right. People sure. didn't, you know, yeah. they didn't equate it with that. All right, my man. So yeah. What about this week? Is it, I'm going to get to see him personally.
Yeah. What, I think now? We need to leave with this. This is important. If we go to the tail end of our show, the real MVP at Ohio State this weekend was not Travion Henderson.
Oh, no. Oh, you're right. I forgot.
It was not Cade Stover, you know, coming up big at tight end. It was not CJ Stroud. The real MVP was a red coat, who are the security guards who work in and around Ohio Stadium, named Matthew Ring. He was the MVP. So we're about an hour before our show. I'm standing outside our little office so we're in St. John Arena in like a corridor of an arena. And I'm on the phone trying to get some information. And Reese walks out of the bathroom, and the security guard's like 10 yards behind him. He's like, excuse me, sir. And Reese is kind of confused. And I'm kind of watching. I'm like, does this guy want a picture? Like, what's going on here? And then Reese turns around to look at the security guard, and he has a piece of toilet paper that was at least down to his knees. It wasn't like a square of toilet paper. It was a tail. All right. It was like a tiger tail of toilet paper hanging out of the back of his pants. And so I'm on the phone trying to figure out like an injury situation to break. And the person's like, okay, this is what's going to happen. And I laughed so loud and so obnoxiously that I actually didn't hear the person on the other end of the phone.
Let me tell you. Okay. Well, okay. There's no excuse for that. And I'm forever grateful to the red coat.
Matthew Ring was his name, by the way.
Matthew, you're the man. You're the MVP. I actually think they should let you dot the I in Script, Ohio. So. But there, I have a pre-show ritual. We'll leave it at that. And in St. John's Arena, you had to do a little makeshift coverage there because they don't have the little things that actually do the coverage for you. And then that led to the mishap. And the aftermath of the story was, I thought that you had taken the toilet paper and tied it to my backpack for post show. Gene Wojciechowski took a long strand of toilet paper and tied it to my backpack. And so I looked at that and I was like, oh, real, real funny. And before long, I get a text from Gino and he said, did you get my present? And I was like, oh, he got even with me because I took a little dig at him all in fun at a class we spoke to at Ohio State on Friday. So he got me back, and Matthew dot the I. So Herb Street always says that it's at Ohio State, it's Woody, Archie, the band, and then football's on down there. In my eyes now, it's Matthew, Woody, Archie, and the band. He's the man. Fight that team across the field, Matthew. You're the man.
The only thing I regret about this is I didn't think of the joke Gene did, because that is like vintage Gene Wojo, like dry humor. Gene is the only person I know who only speaks in sarcasm. So that is right from his dossier of tricks.
As good a dude as there is. Unbelievable report and a tremendous dude. All right. We'll talk more about Alabama, Texas, talk about Stanford and USC, the game. Get to call as Chris Fowler does his annual U.S. Open weekend and affords me the opportunity to call a game on Saturday night. So I'll see Stanford SC. Looking forward to seeing both of those teams, particularly the Trojans. And we'll talk plenty about Alabama and Texas and Iowa State. And there are a couple of sneaky good games. Florida, Kentucky. Oh, yeah. We didn't talk enough about Anthony Richardson today, but
nope,
we will
we didn't.
Later this week. Yes. He looked like I'm not going to put him in the category, but there are at least little flashing images of Vince Young, Cam Newton, Tim Tebow. You know, a lot of there are a lot. I'm not. He's not there yet.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of things that make you go, well, this might happen. I mean,
yeah. the imagination can wander there pretty easily.
Yes, it can. Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah.
He's a long way from injuring himself dancing. That's,
you know. Yeah. Yeah. You know what? People forget about that. I saw a lot on Saturday about how is this guy not playing? He kept getting hurt. And then there were some growing pains, especially against the Dogs last year in terms of the passing game. But he has improved and putting that immense talent to work. Talk plenty about him later on. This was fun, man. Make sure those extra points get done and tell your kids about a still undefeated Iowa. See if we can find a little O against the Cyclone.
Laces out, everybody. Laces out.